Okay, we begin with the actual lecture material, starting with the return to Judea. First thing we need to ask is, why did the return take place? Why was there a return of Judeans from the city and region of Babylon to the area of Judea? And we can answer it in giving three reasons primarily. One, God had promised it. God had promised it through Jeremiah that it would take place. Second, it was, of course, prophesied that the promised Messiah would be born in Bethlehem of Judah. And so obviously one would have to have accomplished a return to make that possible, as well as his functioning, and his mission possible as well. And third, that it is doubtful whether Judaism would have survived as a religion and the Jews as a separate people if they had not had a common center to which they could look. But it's very doubtful that the Jews would have survived as a people or as a religious grouping without a center to which they could look. Now, how did this return take place? Well, we read in the... We read in Ezra chapter 1, of the how, that in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, that the word of the Eternal by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. See, there already is that reason we've already given as one reason for the return. The Eternal stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia. In other words, this is something that Cyrus would not have done on his own, but it's something that God planted in his mind to do. That he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put it also in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus the king of Persia, the Eternal God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is among you of all his people? His God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Eternal, the God of Israel, because he is the God which is in Jerusalem. And whosoever remains in any place where he sojourns, let the men of his place help him with silver and with gold and with goods and with beasts, beside the freewill offering for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. We read also that after having made this particular proclamation, that in verse 7, Cyrus the king brought forth the vessels of the house of the Eternal, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought forth out of Jerusalem, and had put them in the house of his gods. You see, when Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed the Temple of Solomon, he had taken the vessels and had brought them and put them in the house of his gods in Babylon. Now, why had Nebuchadnezzar done that? You might understand looting the temple, but why put the goodies in the temple of his own gods? Flavia? Right. You see, there was no image to be taken and put in the house of his God. Nebuchadnezzar took the images of all the gods of all his conquered subjects and took them and put them in by the image of his chief gods in Babylon, you see. The same reason that we saw first semester, that the Philistines took the ark and put it in the temple of Dagon. same thought process involved, forcing the god of the conquered people to be subject to the god of the conqueror. And therefore, they could maintain their dominion. This was the thought process. But there was no image, and so they did the next best thing. They took the vessel. Now, it's interesting, no mention is made of the ark. Therefore, we have the mystery. What happened to it? And the answer, of course, is either it was destroyed, and therefore it couldn't be brought, or it wasn't captured, and therefore it wasn't brought to Babylon. So we don't really know the answers to what became of it. There are all kinds of ideas and legends and so on. Of course, we've had the movie in recent years of the Raiders of the Lost Ark, and many of you may have wondered, well, how did it ever get to Egypt in the first place? Well, there are two possibilities. There's one legend that the son of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba absconded with the ark when he visited his father in Jerusalem, and he took it with him, and that's how it ended up in Egypt. Another legend has it that Jeremiah somehow secured it and took it with him to Egypt when he was brought down there by those who were fleeing out of Judea. So there are all kinds of legends, and nobody really knows. Someday I'd like to know. I must admit I'm curious. Be that as it may, this is what Cyrus did according to the book of Ezra. Now, for many, many years, it was the fashion of modern critical scholars to look at this passage and say, of course. I'm about to believe that, as well as that, elephants can fly. I mean, after all, this is Cyrus, the king of Persia, who we know from secular sources was a worshiper of his own gods. You can't expect me to believe, so said the modern critical scholars for many years, that he made a proclamation like this, singling out the god of probably the least significant of all of his conquered subjects, and saying that that particular god is the one who gave him all the kingdoms of the earth and commanded him to build a temple in Jerusalem. You've got to be kidding. This is propaganda, written long after the fact kind of thing. Well, we have never discovered a text of this particular proclamation, so there's no way we could, quote, prove it by dotting every I and crossing every T. But what we do know is that Cyrus initiated a new way of administering subject populations, a way that was not followed by the Assyrians, a way that was not followed by the Babylonians, a way that we call cultural pluralism. Now, some of you have had this with me in Western Civ, but a number of you have had Western Civ and Big Sandy, and I don't know if Dr. Anderson bothered to go into this, because in history, one has to pick and choose what one does. One doesn't always pick and choose the same things. What is this policy of cultural pluralism? Well, we know what the word plural means, and we know what the word cultural means. And basically, what it amounted to was the freedom for each ethnic group to follow its own religion and its own social customs and its own language. Now, that's pretty impressive right off the bat, that a conqueror would allow that, total freedom. But if this is interesting to start with, that we have this as a royal permission, as part of the cornerstone of the Persian imperial policy, the second aspect of it is even more remarkable, is that they not only have the freedom to do this, but with the financial as well, financial support of the Persian government. That it wasn't just that they could do it on their own resources, but the Persian government would even assist out of royal revenues each people to do this particular thing. And we find that later on, when they do establish the temple, that they are actually using some of the material and wealth that the kings themselves have sent, the kings of Persia themselves have sent to be used for this purpose. Now, it's interesting that this commitment, especially to the use of their own language, was a very time-consuming thing for the Persians. It meant every royal decree had to be published in every language of the peoples of the empire. Now, you have an illustration of this, if you want to hold your place here in the book of Ezra. If you want to go to the book of Esther for a moment, you may be familiar with the Queen Vashti, who didn't obey her royal husband's command, and then the king asked his counselors, what should I do with her? And they advised him to put her aside and to find a replacement. And it says in chapter 1, in verse 22, Esther chapter 1, verse 22, that he sent letters into all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language. You see? This royal decree was issued in every alphabet that was used in the empire and in every language. And this is not a redundancy, saying to each province according to the writing thereof and to every people after their language, because sometimes people spoke the same language in two different provinces, but they used two different alphabets. This would have been the true case involving the Jews in Judea. They spoke Aramaic, but they wrote it in the Hebrew alphabet. The people of Aram in Damascus spoke Aramaic, the same language, but they didn't write it in the Hebrew alphabet. They had their own alphabet. And so it had to be two copies, you know, even though it was the same language, one for the Arameans and one for the Jews, and then, of course, it would have to be written in other languages as well. In fact, that's why we now are able to read the ancient languages of the Assyrians and the Babylonians. Is when Darius the First, one of the later Persian rulers, ascended the throne, it was with great difficulty that he did so, he commemorated his ascent to the throne by a huge inscription on a rock in Iran. And it's called the Behistun inscription. There's a Behistun inscription. And what he did was to have his decree published in Persian, of course an old form of Persian, in what had previously been the unreadable cuneiform script of the Babylonians. And then I think it was in Elamite, because in that region, that's the three languages that were commonly being used by the people. And since we have the same text in three different languages, and we could read the Persian, we could use what we saw in the Persian to interpret what the other scripts were about. And that's how we unlocked it. It was sort of the Rosetta Stone for the cuneiform script. Because of this commitment to cultural pluralism, he had to do that. Other copies of his proclamation that may have been prepared for other parts of his empire have not survived. But this was chiseled into a rock that was so inaccessible that nobody could practically get up there again easily and erase it. In fact, the man that had to copy the inscription had to let himself down, sitting in a sort of a rope sling from the top of the cliff in order to copy the characters. One of these ambitious imperial English types who went out to serve as consuls and vice consuls in the Near East, not because they were interested so much in diplomatic service, but they were interested in the Near East. And this is one way of having some free time on their hands and also having a salary so they could give vent to their interest in things classical in the Near East. So this is another illustration of this commitment to cultural pluralism. We also have found an inscription I don't think we need to bother with this. That's awfully dark. Sorry about that. This little barrel, it's really not all that big, which sits today in the British Museum, though not in that particular case at the moment. At least I saw it on Friday. I went to the case on Friday and it wasn't there. For some reason they took it out. No explanation, just said removed temporarily. Don't ask me why. Anyway, this is called the Cyrus Cylinder. You can see why it's called a cylinder. It is not a complete inscription. You can see that part of the barrel or the cylinder is missing. But they have been able to translate the vast majority of this inscription, which is written in cuneiform, which of course was not the Persian language or the Persian alphabet. But it was written for the people of Babylon, and so it was written in their language and their alphabet. And I'll read you some of the translation. Now, if you're interested in getting a copy of this, you can find it in a book called Ancient Near Eastern Texts. And the author is Pritchard. We have it in our library. And this is on page 315 and I guess 316, since I seem to have two pages here. Well, anyway, it begins on page 315, so if you wanted to have your own copy, you could get one. I'm just not going to read the whole thing, but I'm just going to start in here with the thing that is most interesting in terms of this proclamation we have in the book of Ezra. Again, why don't you look at Ezra chapter 1, starting with verse 2, and kind of keep that in front of you as I read you this particular inscription. It's speaking about Marduk, who was the chief god in Babylon. Remember, this inscription was written for the Babylonian people in their language. And it's saying about Marduk that he scanned and looked through all the country, searching for a righteous ruler willing to lead him. He pronounced the name of Cyrus, king of Anshan, and declared him to be the ruler of all the world. Then he says, coming down here, he made the Gudi country and all the Manda hordes bow in submission to his feet. And then it goes on and says, and he ordered him to march against the city Babylon. See, without any battle, he made him enter his town Babylon. He delivered it into his hands, Nabonidus the king, who did not worship him, meaning Marduk. And then it goes on and says that, where is this section here? He has commanded me to, wait a minute. Dara, as well as the region of the Gudians, I returned to these sacred cities on the other side of the Tigris, the sanctuaries which have been ruins for a long time. The images which used to live therein and establish for them permanent sanctuaries. I also gathered all their former inhabitants and returned to them their habitations. Furthermore, I resettled upon the command of Marduk, the great lord, all the gods of Sumer and Akkad, whom Nabonidus had brought into Babylon. And then he ends the inscription, at least the part that we have, is, may all the gods whom I have resettled in their sacred cities ask daily Bel and Nebo for a long life for me, and may they recommend me to Marduk, my lord. So you can see that this is in many ways sort of a parallel proclamation, that he gives credit to the Babylonians' chief god, Marduk, as having selected him specially to become ruler over all the kingdoms of the earth, and who have opened the way for his conquests and made them possible. And then he declares that he is restoring the temples that have lain in ruins as a result of the Babylonian destructions, and he's taking the images which had been held captive in Babylon and sending them back to their particular sanctuaries in this particular area. And he asks all the gods to remember him and intercede for him with Bel and Nebo, that they will intercede with Marduk and give him good favor. So we don't have a literal word-for-word similar inscription or proclamation, but we do have something that is very, very similar in content. And so as a result of the discovery of this particular cylinder, it can now be shown that this is not some fiction of the imagination, but what we have here in the text of Ezra chapter 1 is not a unique proclamation, but simply one of a series in which Cyrus made proclamations to the different subject peoples and the names of the god of each subject people, saying that he had been taken by their god to be their ruler and to have all these kingdoms as his dominion, and has been charged to give them back their sanctuary and to allow them to go back to their homes and to reestablish their ways of worship. So apparently where it says that God stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, it wasn't just to make this one proclamation, but we have to understand it in the sense that God stirred up the spirit of Cyrus to establish this policy and to issue these multiple proclamations, of which this is one. And so as a result, the Judeans were able to have the promise of God fulfilled. They were able to go back, and they were able to reestablish the temple with royal permission and to practice their own religion without any interference. Anybody have any questions about this? Yes. That's a possibility, but I would find it hard to understand then if that was the reason why he would have also issued the other proclamations and made it a general policy for the empire. It's possible, of course, that he felt, well, maybe I was meant to do it for this, but why should I treat these people differently than anybody else? If I'm going to do it for them, I might as well do it for everybody. So there is a possibility that that is something that may have happened. Because we know Daniel reached a high position in his kingdom. And that is, of course, something that might have happened. Because remember in that prophecy in Isaiah 45, it also not only talks about God naming him as his anointed, but also indicates that the gates of Babylon would open before him without a struggle. And that's exactly what happened. And so that might have impressed him even more than just the statement of his name being there all the time. So that is a possibility. Anything else? David? No, not necessarily Marduk. You see, he's addressing that inscription to the Babylonians and explaining why he's giving them this permission to establish their sanctuaries, you know, to their own gods. It would make no sense to address it in terms of some other god to these people. And so he quotes Marduk as being his supreme benefactor. Well, you see, this is difficult to say because, you see, it was a tendency in the ancient world also to identify the chief god of one people with the chief god of another. Those of you that had the class first semester may remember that the chief god of the Assyrians was Ninurta. And remember, as part of the Assyrian rule over Judea, they insisted that Ninurta be worshipped. But it didn't have to be worshipped under the name Ninurta. They decided that for everything from Damascus west, Ninurta would be worshipped under the name of Hadad Rimmon, because they associated the two gods as being the same. And for the Canaanites and Phoenicians, this was no problem, because they had already associated Hadad Rimmon with Baal. And so therefore, they were willing to worship Baal under that name as well as under Baal's name. They saw him as the same deity. Later on in the Greek period, there was the tendency to identify Zeus in Egypt with Amun, the Egyptian sun god, who was considered the chief of their gods. So this was a tendency in the ancient world to say, well, we call this god by this name. These other people worship the same being but call them by that name, you see. And so this may have been involved in his mentality as well. It's hard for us to know exactly because we don't have any specific information that would answer that more carefully. Yes, Brian.
Is this the only other proclamation?
To my knowledge, this is the only one. But from other records we have in the Persian period, we know they allowed this throughout the empire, you see. And the Persian government spent a lot of money reestablishing all the sanctuaries and allowing the captive peoples the Babylonians had gathered to go back to their own dwelling places if they felt like it. They weren't forced to. And in fact, as we'll see, many chose not to. But they had that opportunity. And so therefore, the presumption is that since we have one proclamation preserved in the Bible and another one in this archaeological find, that there were others, and these are just not the only two, is it, for that reason. Roger. Old Persian, cuneiform, I think the Babylonian form, and I think the other one was Elamite. I'm not positive, but I think so. I'd have to go back and double check that. Because given where it was written, that would be the language that would make sense for that area. The old Persian, of course, was in the middle because it was the language of the conquerors, so it got the most prominent position. Yeah. I don't know if they assumed it was published. Well, you see, this is an edict for the Jews, and that they are scattered in the Persian realm, you see, and so therefore it would have to be circulated to wherever they might be. Now, the Babylonians were not scattered. They were still where they were. They had just been conquered. So it was not necessary to circulate, you know, this particular inscription. Other peoples that the Babylonians had previously conquered would have been scattered also, and they would have to have been spread around. You know, the different copies of the proclamation. Yeah. Oh, okay. Now let's turn our attention to what happened after the permission was granted. We find that in verse 5 of Ezra chapter 1, that there then rose up the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites, with all them whose spirit God had raised, to go up to build the house of the Eternal, which is in Jerusalem. And that is, God sort of began to stir people to want to respond, but of course not everybody God stirred did respond, but, you know, that's why there was any response at all, because God was working behind it. That's interesting. I must make a note of that verse for another reason. And all they that were about them, who were not mindful to go up to Jerusalem themselves, in other words, all they that were about them strengthened their hands with vessels of silver, with gold, with goods and with beasts and with precious things, besides all that was willingly offered. Then we come down here and to verse 8. It's just talking about the vessels that had been taken out of the temple of Marduk. That these did Cyrus, king of Persia, bring forth by the hand of Mithridat, the treasurer, and numbered them to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. And this is the number of them: 30 charges of gold, 1,000 charges of silver, 9 and 20 knives, 30 basins of gold, and so on. It gives the rest of the description. All of these did Sheshbazzar bring up with them of the captivity that were brought up from Babylon unto Jerusalem. And so we have mention here in chapter 1 of a return from Babylon. Chapter 2 is a listing of individuals who went up from Babylon to Jerusalem. But what is interesting about the listing in chapter 2? Did you notice anything interesting after having read chapter 1? Right. And that opens the door to a great scholarly controversy as to what relationship existed between Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel. And one school of scholars holds the two are the same person, that they're just different names. Now, you might say, well, why? Well, how many names did Daniel have? Two. Daniel is his Hebrew name, but what was his Babylonian name? Belteshazzar. Not Belshazzar, that's of course the king who saw the handwriting on the wall, but Belteshazzar. It's given there in Daniel chapter 1. You know the names Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those are the Babylonian names for Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the other three Jewish youths, you see. Now, Sheshbazzar is a Babylonian name. Zerubbabel is a Hebrew name. Therefore, it's not impossible that you're talking about the same person, you see. It's not impossible. And that you simply are using the names interchangeably. There is another school, of course, that holds that this is not true, that they are two separate individuals. And that possibly Sheshbazzar was an uncle, an older uncle of Zerubbabel. Now, why do they feel that this is the case? Well, largely as a result of, I mentioned, I think it's in chapter 5, yes. Zerubbabel is the author of this particular statement that we read in Ezra chapter 5. And in verse 14, or we can back up and get the context in verse 13. In the first year of Cyrus, the king of Babylon, the same king Cyrus made a decree to build this house of God. And the vessels also of gold and silver of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that was in Jerusalem, and brought them into the temple of Babylon, those did Cyrus the king take out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered unto one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. Now that would be a very odd way of Zerubbabel to talk about himself. I think you would agree. And so therefore, I tend to side with the school of scholars that says they're two different people. Yes. In the same chapter? Well, that happens with Daniel. In the book of Daniel. And sometimes in the same chapter, within a few verses, he's first called Daniel and then he's called Belteshazzar. You see, so that alone is... that's a good thought. It's good to think in those lines, but I'd be hard put to prove it on that basis because we have the example of Daniel where that exactly happens to him. But I think this one in Ezra 5 is a little more substantive. It's a more difficult thing to explain away. Why Zerubbabel will talk about himself under his other name doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So what apparently we have here is two separate returns. The first one, immediately after Cyrus's decree is proclaimed, under the leadership of Sheshbazzar, and we are not given any details about it, or how they made their way, or how many people went up with him, or who they were, any of those things. None of those things is said. About, you know, how they went about all this. The only thing we know that Sheshbazzar for sure did Again, we can go to chapter 5. We find in verse 16, then came the same Sheshbazzar and laid the foundation of the house of God which is in Jerusalem. So Sheshbazzar attempted to start the temple at that time. Now, it's unclear whether this was a first founding, and then when Zerubbabel came later, he again started the foundation because it hadn't prospered under Sheshbazzar. Or we've got a situation where Sheshbazzar leaves first with the vessels, and then some short time later, Zerubbabel leaves. And at the time Zerubbabel gets there, Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel is also present. You have the foundation established for the temple. It's unclear. It could be this way, and it could also be that Sheshbazzar comes back and lays the foundation, and then much later Zerubbabel comes back and has to do it over again. We just have no way of knowing for sure. This is a way that something would be hard to establish completely. But what is particularly interesting, when you read chapter 2, did anything strike you? Yes. Okay. Anything else that strikes you? This may, of course, be the result of some imperfect record keeping, because Nehemiah is much, much later in time. This return is taking place around 538, and Nehemiah is 445, so it's almost 100 years later, so that might account for that. What else strikes you, Dan? Yes, let's take a look at that. Precisely, unless I have miscounted, there were 42,360 people who mentioned as returning. That's in itself interesting. Cyrus says, anyone who wants to go back may do so. You know, how many people are in Babylon? How many Jews? At least 1 million. Maybe more. And of that million or more, 42,360 decide to go back under Zerubbabel. Now, some may have gone back under, of course, Sheshbazzar. But still, you're not dealing in huge numbers of people. Why is it, first of all, that we have so few people taking advantage of this freedom? Why is it that so few people go back? Why would you imagine? Just think about human nature and think about the fact they've been living in Babylon for 70 years. Or thereabouts, you know, what could explain why so few take advantage of this? Neil? Think you could get that unstuck? Well, this slide I was about to show you shows a family with their cart of possessions pulling up to Jerusalem, and there's nothing but ruins. And that's the point. You see, they were very comfortable in Babylon, which was a thriving metropolis. Remember, it had not been damaged in the Persian conquest. The city had been opened to Cyrus from within, and so there had been no reason to destroy. In fact, Cyrus gave decrees, which is mentioned in the Cyrus Cylinder even, that his troops did not loot the city. They were under strict instructions not to treat the conquered people as slaves or to take away their property, you see. And so, therefore, things were very comfortable in Babylon. And not all the Jews were living in Babylon directly, but even if they were in some of the villages and towns round about, they had struck down roots, as Jeremiah had advised them. They owned property. They had farms. They had businesses. They were well established. Many of them spoke the local language. and would have had to recover the old language, you know, in order to go back, which would have been a difficulty. So they weighed the comfort of Babylon on one hand against the ruins of Judea and Jerusalem on the other. And they say, that's not for me. You know, I'm not that kind of a pioneering spirit to want to go back and rough it, you see. Plus, too, you have to remember that the journey was a very dangerous and a very long journey. They couldn't get in a 747 and just fly over. You know, they had to load up their wagons and truck along for months in order to reach Jerusalem. And a lot of people just were put off by the rigors of the journey. Yeah, thank you for your efforts there. See? This is an artist representation, I think, from the Reader's Digest book, People of the Bible, Times and How They Lived, I think is the one I took this from. You know, this was not something that a lot of people could get terribly excited about. You know, obviously it appealed to those that had a strong orientation and a desire to go back to the land God had given them and to see the temple reestablished and to be able to actually worship in that temple personally. That meant a great deal to them. They would have gone back. And so that's why, number one, a lot of people didn't. But even with this, it's interesting the disparity that we have here. How many priests do we find here returning? Anybody can count that and come up with how many priests we've got? I need an eraser. As usual, it's hiding from me. How many? Who has it tabulated? No one yet? They're at the back of the list. The Nethinims. Here it is, verse 36. The priests, the children of Jedidiah, the house of Yeshua, 973. The children of Immer, who is also a priest, 1,052. The children of Pasher, 1,247. The children of Haram, 1,017. Now, unless I made a mistake, it's 4,289 priests. What percentage? About. Pretty close to 10% of the whole group are priests. But think for a second. How did one qualify to be a priest? What was the only qualification for being a priest? Alan? Yeah. You couldn't, first of all, you had to be of the tribe of Levi as opposed to Benjamin or Judah. But that alone was not enough. Of all the families in the whole tribe of Levi, only one family was the family of the priest, and that's the family of Aaron and all of his descendants, male. In other words, if a priest had a daughter and she didn't marry a priest, her children were not priests. You had to be descended in the male line from a descendant of Aaron. So you have a tiny fraction of those in the total community in Babylon who are priests, and yet 10% of the total people coming back are priests. That's quite an impressive number. When you consider that they were very few in the total group in Babylon, and yet they total 10% of the total returnees. And that becomes particularly interesting when we consider the Levites. And you can count them one of two ways. It says Levites, and then it says singers and porters. Now, we could include the singers and porters as possibly being Levites. Though, you know, they're not listed specifically that way. If we just take those identified as Levites, we have 74 Levites. In other words, every one of the tribe of Levi who is not of the household of Aaron is automatically a Levite. So obviously they're much more numerous than the priests. And yet you've got 4,289 priests and 74 Levites. They seem to be a distinct underrepresentation. If we add in the porters and the singers, we can add in another 128 singers And how many? 139. So another 128 and another 139 porters. Even so, if we add them in, considering that there were so many of them in the dispersion in Babylon, why are there so few coming back when there's so many priests coming back? Any attempt you would like to launch to explain that behavior? Yes. Yeah, they had the drudgery. And they didn't have a whole lot of status that went with the drudgery of the service of the temple. The priests, once the temple gets going again, they've got a good thing, you know, might say, because they have a very high status position, socially speaking, and of course they'd be assured of a very good income. Now, that's to look at things carnally, but they may very well have been carnally motivated, I don't know. One could also maybe on the give the priests the benefit of the doubt and say that since they were priests, they cared that much more for the things of God, and therefore they were more strongly motivated to sacrifice and go back. It's possible. I don't want to demean their memory and say they all were materialistically minded. I'm sure some were, since we're not dealing with converted people. But I'm sure that many were idealistic too. So in case we can explain the very high percentage of priests by either greater zeal or the hope of material and social gain. The problem with the Levites is that there was no hope of real material reward or gain, and so they seem to have been distinctly under-motivated. So this is an interesting situation. If you take only the 74 Levites, you end up with about 0.2% of the total group. And if you include in all of these together, you end up with 0.8%. But still, it's dramatic, you know, that since you've got a whole tribe to draw from, the tribe of Levi, one of three tribes in the captivity, that you only end up with 0.8% of those people. That almost everybody else is a Benjaminite or a Jew who comes back. Something else that's very interesting about this chapter. Did you notice anything else? Maybe is there anything here that you would not have expected to find in the list? Maybe it's a little bit surprising that it's in the list. It's near the end. Yes, Robert?
The people who came along without
their property genealogy. Okay, these probably, these were those who claimed to be priests but couldn't find their genealogy, and so they weren't allowed to function as priests. But maybe that's because they hoped they would still be accepted. But you have this listing of the animals, very specific listing of the animals. Why bother? What did we study last semester that would explain that? Dan? Yeah, because what this listing is not just a listing of the people per se. It's a community. It's the listing of the community. And if you're giving a listing of the community, you have to include everybody that's part of the community. And animals are fully members of the community. They have to be accounted for with the same rigorous attention as human beings. Another thing that we should notice is that people don't just come back and say, oh, there's a choice piece of land. I think I'll go over there and settle there. They went back to the places from which they had come. This is a resettling in their old homes, or at least home areas. And that's why you find these cities as being mentioned in the text as being settled. And it tends to put the kibosh on the idea that huge hordes of Israelites of the northern tribes came back with the Jews. Because the only areas that are being settled that were not properly part of the house of Judah are Jericho, Bethel, and possibly Joppa and Ono and Nibalat. And these areas are just north of the border of the kingdom of Judah. And it's easy to understand why some of these people might have been in the captivity in Babylon. Because either these northerners, when the Assyrians took the north because they were right above the border, could easily flee into the south for safety. And then when the turmoil died down, they went back into their homes. Then when the Babylonians took over, they of course took them away also. Or the Israelites were removed from here, and Jews just drifted across the border that far to take their place. It could be either one. But it's interesting that you just have the cities of Judah being mentioned here. You don't have the cities of Naphtali and the cities of Manasseh and way up north in Zebulun being resettled. You have Judeans going back, not the northerners, as some of our detractors claim. And this is why I made mention of chapter 1, verse 5. Who is it that organizes the return? The chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites. Judeans are in the captivity. You don't have the northerners mixed in with them to any great extent. They're subsumed under those headings, the few that are there. But the main body of the northerners have long since moved out of this area and are now in between the Caspian and the Black Seas, and they're on their way eventually towards Europe. Now, what I want you to do for next time in the assignment in the Bible is to read, of course, chapters 3 through 6 to become familiar with the details, the problems the Jews had in their return. In the case of Haggai and Zechariah, what I want you to focus on are the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah dealing with Zerubbabel. I want you to look at those prophecies where Zerubbabel is specifically mentioned very carefully and think, what would I think these prophecies meant about Zerubbabel if I wasn't reading them in Haggai and I wasn't reading them in Zechariah? What would I think these prophecies meant if I was reading them in Isaiah or Ezekiel? The same words, but they were in a different book. I think when you read it, you'll understand what I mean by think about how your perception of those prophecies might change. Okay? And we'll talk about that next time.